Hey, everybody, welcome to this week's podcast. Before I get to my very special guest this week, November 25th and 26th, that's Thanksgiving weekend, Friday and Saturday, I'm going to be headlining at Gotham Comedy Club here in New York City. Five shows. If you're in the area, come on out and go to GothamComedyClub.com for tickets. Put in the promo code Paul, all caps, Paul, all caps, and you get half off the ticket because you're a fan of my show. November 25th and 26th, hope you can make it. And my guest this week, icon, and I don't use that word lightly, and someone who's a legend, especially a comedy legend to me, Rob Reiner, the director, actor, director of Princess Bride, This is Spinal Tap, A Few Good Men, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, it goes on, and the star of All in the Family, the iconic sitcom in the 70s, he played Meathead. Just so cool to talk to Rob about his career, how he got started, working with greats like his dad, Carl Reiner, the brilliant comedian, actor, Billy Crystal, Tom Hanks, working on A Few Good Men, his political views, and we sit with his son, Nick, as well. His son is a recovering addict. He wrote a film about it. Rob directed it, where they work together. Just a really great conversation that covers a whole range of topics, and it's also available on video on my YouTube channel, just under Paul Mercurio, M-E-C-U-R-I-O, Paul Mercurio, my YouTube channel. We have this on video as well. Nice conversation at the desk with Rob, and then his son Nick joins us, so check that out. We did it at the Anthony Cumia Studios. And please check me out November 25th and 26th at Gotham Comedy Club. Thanks, everybody. I get bombarded on Twitter. Like, I just get so beat up by the people on the right. You know, yeah. You're an a-hole, you're this, you're that. Yeah. It's so funny, we were talking about free speech once. We're good? We're going to start right now, nice and loose. We're talking politics.
I thought we were already.
Were we sort of rolling already?
Yeah, I thought we were already.
I'm sorry. I'm very, very excited to say that I have this guest. When my producer, my booker asked me if I wanted to talk with Rob Reiner, I wrote back, "Are you out of your mind?" Yes. Emmy Award winning actor, Golden Globe nominated actor and director. And just as a director, Stand By Me, This is Spinal Tap, Princess Bride, hilarious, Few Good Men, When Harry Met Sally. You really, really got to apply yourself more.
Yeah, I got to get to work here.
Exactly. And you have a great movie out now, very personal movie. In the center of it is your relationship with your son being Charlie. But we have something in common. I lived in New Rochelle for a while.
You did? Where in New Rochelle did you?
I lived at Glen Island Park when I was a lawyer and investment banker on Wall Street, and then I quit to be a comedian. And I sold my apartment in New York City, and I needed a cheap place, so I moved to a rooming house for $327 in Glen Island Park.
Hysterical. Because, you know, New Rochelle, that was the home of Rob and Laura Petrie.
Right, yeah.
The Dick Van Dyke Show.
Bonnie Meadow Road.
Well, Rob and Laura lived on 148 Bonnie Meadow Road, and we lived at 48 Bonnie Meadow Road. So we lived down the block from
That's great. That's such a great show. And I want to talk about that in a minute, but I want to get into your directing, because you said something in an interview that I saw that really surprised me. It was about your mom, Estelle, who is a singer and an actor, and really had a big influence and effect on you as a director. And, you know, you said that my ability to direct, I get more of my talent from my mother. Your father, obviously, is the brilliant Carl Reiner, and I'm sure you get talents from him. But my mother's ability to see things in an artistic way, to be able to understand how music works, you have to have a working knowledge of a lot of things in order to make films, not just know where to point the camera. What was it about your mother's background that fed you?
Well, a number of things. Number one is she was musical. Mm. She also had an artistic sense. She was an artist, a painter, and she was a draftswoman. Even during the Second World War, she drafted for planes and tanks.
Oh, really?
Things like that. And so she had that ability. Plus, she was very, very liberal in the 30s. I mean, very, very liberal. And, you know, she had a very deep thinking way of the world. I mean, she was tortured. I mean, she was a tortured person, and she had problems, but she did think of the world in a very deep way, and she was politically oriented, and so she had a big, broad view of the world and a lot of different artistic abilities.
Yeah.
I think I got a lot of that from her. I mean, I've often said, you know, that Stand By Me, which I think at the time represented the best representation of my personality was really a combination of my parents, because it has a sense of humor, there's comedy there, but it also has a kind of melancholy and a dramatic part.
Yeah, you said of your,
my mother.
Yeah, you've said of yourself, and you, some of your comedy comes from that place of being tortured.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of comedians.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think people in general, yeah.
I mean, comedians, most of the stand-ups I know, they're angry. And anger is from a place of torture.
I always say if my mother hugged me two more times, I wouldn't be a comedian.
Yes.
But honestly, my mother's 88. She runs her own business.
Maybe she can still do it.
Well,
maybe she can still give you that little
extra. I don't know. Here's how my mother hugs me. She kind of comes over and she kind of goes like that.
Oh, yeah,
that.
Gives
that's
you one of the
closest. The,
okay, yeah. So
And my wife came and she loves my wife and she goes, "Oh, I'm so happy to see you," she said to me. And then she said, "Oh, and I'm even more happy to see you." And she actually said that in front of me.
Of course, yeah, because, you know, you're not, you know, she can't believe that you could actually attract a woman. That's what she's astounded by that. Now let me ask you something.
Yes.
How does your wife hug you? Does she give you a good hug?
Does she give you one of those? She gives me a good hug, and sometimes I'll put my head on her shoulders when I'm feeling really needy and like I need a hug.
Yeah, which she is gets probably all the time.
Exactly.
The mother you have.
Exactly. It was brutal.
There's a lot of pressure on your wife.
My mother can't hear. She gets customers are in the store and locks them in the store.
Really?
She locked a 6-year-old woman in the store for 4 hours one day.
But not intentionally.
No. She just forgets. She runs out of gas. She's one of those people.
Otherwise, we're talking about a much
it's a criminal,
much bigger problem.
Criminal charges.
You.
And she could never appreciate my decision to leave Wall Street to be a comedian, which I understand. And I worked on The Daily Show for a long time. And it was only when I came home with an Emmy Award for The Daily Show and I took a picture with her, she kind of got it. But then still she didn't. But then through other people, customers would come in the store and she'd have like a picture of me, an article, whatever. And she goes, "You know, he works on that show. I watch it." Because my mother doesn't like. And so she could only appreciate through the eyes of other people.
Right. So basically when other people validated you.
Right, exactly.
Then it was okay for her to say.
Exactly.
Because up until that point, you were a schmuck.
Exactly.
Yeah. But thanks, Mom.
Are you still tortured, or you got it all figured out?
Oh, no. I have my, my issues that I wrestle with my entire life.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, that's the charge you have. You know, you're dealt a certain hand, and you go along, and you try to make the best out of it and try to understand it as best you can. And I think if you get to a good place, you can start managing it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I do.
A lot of self-criticism, which
there's a lot of, you know, emotional depression things. Yeah. I deal with all that stuff.
And
it's on an ongoing basis.
Yeah.
And, you know, listen, the thing that I feel worst about is not about me anymore. It's about how my children, are affected by it, how my wife is affected by it. Those are the things that bother me more than anything. I'm functioning, you know, and I'm doing my career and living and doing fine.
Yeah.
I know it has an effect on other people, just as my parents had an effect on me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the movie Being Charlie is based on your son Nick's experience from 15 to 19 having drug addiction issues and examines that sort of it gets behind the reason for drug addiction. And you have a really interesting quote where you said recovery programs like AA work very well for some people, but not all. I personally don't view alcohol or drug use as a disease, but more of a self-medication one uses to treat deeper emotional problems. And you also talk about Johan Hari's book that sort of has a proof of that. What was it? Were you concerned that you couldn't direct this film because it was so personal, because it did involve you?
Well, initially, I had a thought of doing a film from the father and the child's perspective. There were two books that came out, and this was when Nick was, you know, in the midst of the most difficult time of his life. He's doing really good now. I mean, for the last 3-4 years, he's been really good. But in that period, when he was struggling the most, there were these two books that came out. By Nick Sheff was called Tweaked, and by his father called A Beautiful Boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, that's interesting. I mean, it shows this issue from both perspectives.
Okay.
And I thought, well, maybe that's something I could. Certainly, I'm connected. I'm in the middle of it. And that was the problem for me. I was in the middle of it, and I didn't have any kind of perspective, and I couldn't really see the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
So I kind of just said, oh, forget about that. And then, oddly enough, I mean, Nick meets a guy in rehab. They kind of start talking about characters and people and situations that they've seen. They start jotting down notes. And when they get out, Nick contacts him and they start fooling around with, at that point, a half hour comedy, a half hour, you know, TV show.
Right.
And I had no idea. I had no idea that that's what they were doing. They were doing this on their own.
Oh, this was going to be a half hour.
Yeah, I mean, they were just, you know, I don't know that they thought what they were going to do with, but they were, you know, just going to explore their experiences.
Right.
And they showed it to me and I thought, well, you know, there's some laughs in here. It's funny, but I think that there's much deeper. And I think there's a, you know, much more that you could get out of this. And then they went back and they wrote an hour. Comedy drama,
right?
And it was centered in rehab. There wasn't really any focus on the parents outside the rehab,
right?
Atmosphere. And we tried to set it up at different places. We went to like 7 different, TV outlets, and we got turned down everywhere.
They just thought it was too heavy a topic.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know why
you got turned down at 7.
I get turned down all the time. I get turned down all the time from actors. From
it must be your personality.
It is. I'm sure it is. No, I mean, it's just the vagaries of the business.
Yeah.
You know, you never know. I don't ask questions why. I just know if it's something I like and I want to do, I just do whatever I can do to try to get it done.
Yeah.
So then I said to Nick, I said, maybe there's a movie in this. You know, maybe we can explore the movie. And that was when we brought in the idea of the parents as well. And so I thought, okay, this is, at this point, I felt I had a little bit more distance.
Yeah.
I could tell the story a little bit better. But I got to say that in the process of working with Nick and Matt Alisafin on the screenplay, which took place over a period of almost a year through the production, I learned a lot more than I ever imagined. I mean, I was forced, you know, by this process to really understand what Nick was going through. And hopefully, I think he got to understand a little bit what I and his mother were going through, and it was a very good thing. I mean, we didn't set out to do, you know, have it be a catharsis or be therapy or anything, but it turned out that that's what it was. It did turn out.
And if it's too personal, you don't have to say, but what was something that you learned through that process that, because you were in it at the time, you didn't understand or didn't see, but through the film?
Well, the main thing that I learned is that these programs, they're very much cookie cutter, and they give you a certain way of approaching your child.
Mm-hmm.
And we even reflected in the film when the father says, you know, I listen to anybody with a desk and a diploma, because you're frightened, you know.
You don't know what to do. Yeah.
You don't know what to do. Your main responsibility as a parent is to keep your child safe. So here is your child is doing something that is possibly not only terrible, but could be cause death, and you're scared. So you latch on to, you know, experts. And what I learned is that I know my son better. My wife knows my son better than experts do, and that he is smart, and I have to listen to him. I have to listen to what he's telling me more. And they would tell me, don't listen, because whatever he tells you, he's going to be manipulating
you
and, on. So I did learn about that. And that was the big thing. Yeah, for me.
Hey, Ben, are we keying anything into this? You do it later? Okay. This thing that you just mentioned, I'm a father. He's a teenager. I have had my son on my podcast 3 times.
How old is he?
He's 15.
15.
And once with 2 other teenagers. And the first time I had him on, it was just us. I didn't have a guest that week, and I was desperate, so I said, you're going to be on my podcast. And we talked about that he has pubic hair, and he wouldn't tell me how much, and it was a whole other conversation.
Well, at 15, if he doesn't have any...
yeah, it's a problem.
You got to assume.
Well, he has hairy armpits, so I said, what do you got going down there? And he goes, that's inappropriate. I go, but when I was a kid, I was a swimmer at a boys' club, and I grew up in Rhode Island. You had to swim naked at the ages of 7 to 9.
Really?
Yeah, it was required. You couldn't wear a bathing suit.
Who was the coach? Jerry Sandusky? I mean, what are we talking about here?
It was Father O'Neill, no.
Okay. Well, I don't know that at every swim club.
You've never heard of that before.
No, I used to compete.
I'm not making this up.
It was in the program.
You'd send it home, and they said the rationale was that they didn't want the lint from the bathing suit to clog the filter of the pool.
It was a lint problem. Oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah, let's hide behind the lint.
Yeah. The pool was filled with 7-year-old boys. It was 98% pee.
Yeah.
So I'm having this conversation with him, and I said to him, what is the one thing that you think at this age we don't understand about you that you would really like us to understand?
What did he say?
Immediately said what you learned, that we can make decisions for ourselves, that we can think for ourselves, and that you hover too much and worry too much, and you have to trust that we kind of are figuring it out.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I think, you know, in Nick's case, I think both his mother and I overreacted the first time when we heard of, you know, the problems. And I think we just way, way overreacted. So, yeah, no, I think that's...
You also said something interesting that I heard you say as a result of this, that you should have listened to your own gut and instincts more because you know your son better than anybody else.
That's
and I thought that was, and I'm going through that right now, not with drugs, but with baseball, and he's struggling with baseball and he really loves it and his coach is being really hard on him. And it's this, and you live through them, even if it's something as innocuous as baseball. And speak to that for me, because I'm struggling with that right now. Like, I literally reached out in one day to three different baseball coaches. My son was in a bad slump, and it was really affecting him. And then that started to affect his play on the field and blah, blah, blah. And I just felt lost. It's obviously not the same issue.
All this stuff is...
It's really resonated with me.
All this stuff is connected because, you know, if he's struggling with something... You don't want to add fuel to the fire, you know? You want to make him feel like, okay, so you're doing that, and then you'll do that. I mean, you'll
I'm not good at that.
You know, I mean...
I'm like, we got to fix this.
Yeah.
And then I get...
And I think it will fix itself. I mean, I used to coach, you know, T-ball and five pitch and all the way up to Pony League, and their parents would always be like crazy. And I would say to the parents, I said, look, you see all those kids out there? Not one of them is going to be in the major league. They're just having fun. Let them have some fun.
Yeah.
Whatever happens, happens.
Yeah.
It's going to be okay.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget this, but there was a time when we had T-ball. They're 5 and 6 year olds.
Right.
And they always play. Everybody plays and everybody hits and everybody plays every position, which is good.
Yeah.
You know. And then the second year, they decided they were going to have playoffs. They're going to actually have competitive games with three outs, and so you don't bat through the order and everything. And the guys came and said, and you can try to win. You can put your best players in your best positions. You don't have to put them everywhere. Everybody plays every position. And so I thought, this is weird, you know. These kids have been used to playing everywhere. So I went to the parents. I said, I talked to all the parents. I said, look, they're telling us we can try to win or just go the way we've always gone. I'm going to throw it in your hands. What do you want me to do? And every parent said win.
Wow.
They all said win.
At 5 and 6.
And this is their kids. That means some of their kids are going to be playing, you know, in the outfield.
Right.
Nobody will ever touch the ball.
Right.
And so I thought, this is, you know, this told me a lot. Let the kids play. Let them do what they do. Unless they're doing something that's, you know, really bad, you know, then you got to, and even then, you got to work with them. You know, listen to
them. Oh, yeah. And I even suggested a sports psychologist for my son. And I'm like, my wife's like, and my son's like, I don't want to see a sports psychologist
because
he was really in his own head. He's gotten through it. My wife just said to me, you have to stop talking about it.
Let it go.
Instead of him coming.
Does he have fun playing?
He does. But the problem was we're getting concerned about, and I really felt bad, is that he was not having fun because he was so wrapped up. You know, I think next you start thinking about college in a few years, and I think he'd like to play college. Well, he's not going to go to the big leagues, and he knows that, but he loves the sport.
Doesn't matter.
He can play Division III. Yeah, right.
Enjoy it.
But when you lose it, and so your instinct that you weren't listening to when your son was going through this was, going back, if you could do it again and listen to an instinct or a gut to do something that you didn't do, what would you have done differently in that moment if you had listened to yourself?
Well, I would have trusted my instinct is to stay with my son, regardless of what struggles he was going, and to get him to talk to me about this and know that he was in a safe place and that I wasn't going to punish him. That I think he felt like, I'm going to, you know, if I'm doing something bad, I'm going to get punished. And then I'm going to hide stuff. If I'm going to get punished, I got to keep hiding stuff.
Right.
So that's one of the things I'm hoping comes out of this movie, Being Charlie, that we made, which is that if somebody's struggling with a problem, you don't punish them because they're having a problem.
Yeah.
You try to help them.
Yeah.
You know, and so the whole idea of decriminalizing drugs and changing the criminal justice system so that if somebody's arrested for drug use, you're not punishing them, you're trying to help them because they're not doing anything evil. They're just trying to, you know, heal themselves or self-medicate because they're in pain.
Well, this goes back to talk about the book. You've talked about this book, Johann's book, and this really interesting study he did involving lab rats. And this goes to the issue that you want to get home with this, and I think you experience, is the real, in your opinion, many of the times, the reasons people use drugs like this. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, there's the classic experiment that everybody's heard about where they put a lab rat in a very small, confined cage, and they give them two bottles. One has water, and one has water laced with cocaine.
Mm.
And the lab rat...
That's what that is, by the way.
It's like cocaine in there? Okay. No wonder I'm so hopped up. I'm going to put it over. If there's anybody, I'll save this for later when I have to go on another show. The lab rat would always go to the one laced with cocaine because it got him, you know, it made him feel better. And so the assumption was that, it's addictive. It's an addict. You got addicted to it because you'd rather have that than the water.
Right.
Then they had this experiment where they took these rats and they put them in a huge park. You know, with they could run around. There were male, female rats. They were basically an environment that felt good.
Mm.
And they had also the water and the water laced with cocaine. And the rats would go to the water because their situation was good. They didn't want to alter their feelings.
Right.
They felt good.
Emotionally, they were
stable.
Why
would they want to change it if they feel good?
Yeah.
And so it's about being in a cage. You're in a cage, and you don't feel good about yourself.
Yeah.
You want to do anything to make yourself feel better.
Yeah. What do you think your son took away? You said you both learned what you were going through in a deeper way.
Well, he's right here. You can ask him.
Oh, that's your son.
Ask him. That's Nick. You know,
wow, I guess I should have known that at the beginning.
Come in here.
Come in here, man.
He wants to know what you took away. Here, I'm going to get you one of these.
Yeah, yeah. Nice to meet you. This is so great that you're on. Thank you for coming on.
I was really interested in what you were saying about the baseball thing and how relatable it was.
Yeah. It just, someone said having a child is like your heart is running around outside your body unprotected.
Yeah.
And I couldn't put it any better. And I was thinking on the way here, and I try to talk about this stuff in my act because this is the stuff that I think matters, is like I am at times that parent that I would mock who lives through his kid. And I'm sure when you were going through your pain, your dad was going through. My son is in a baseball slump, which is nothing compared to what you guys went through. And I literally couldn't sleep a couple of nights. And so I totally understand. So I'm curious, what did you figure out was going on with him during all of this as a result of the movie?
Well, I think I'm lucky in the sense that I have parents that care about me. And because of that, when I would go out and do, you know, things like drugs and stuff like that, I'd feel a tremendous amount of guilt because I'd think, oh, they're thinking about me right now. They want me to do good. And most people don't have, not most people, but some people don't have parents that are, you know, have any interest in them.
Yeah. By the way, we're talking with Nick Reiner and his father, Rob Reiner. Nick had a drug issue in his teens and beat it and wrote a movie about it. And his dad directed it. And
you see, he just said something that really got me, which is that deep down he trusted that we loved him and that we were there for him, and that put a little bit of a break on certain things. I mean, it's a desire to survive, you know, and that put a little, and I think that's where we made the mistake, is that we didn't trust that he had that.
If you supported him as opposed to you were punishing
him. We were definitely.
Well, meaning like
grounding
him. You can't use the car. You got to stay home.
No,
all
no,
that
just
stuff.
Just the whole idea of throwing him into a rehab place. You know, just saying okay. And it is. There's a punitive aspect.
But if you hadn't done that, how could you treat him on? You couldn't treat him on your own.
No, not on our own. But we could have maybe just worked with him with a therapist, you know, been a little bit more active in that way. I think we just overreacted, but I mean,
Nick,
I love hearing that he said that because I knew he has that in
him,
and there's a part of him that wants to survive, and he doesn't want to, you know, kill himself or anything.
Why were you so deep into drugs? What do you think, maybe with distance you can answer this, maybe not, was the sort of the underlying issues for you that were driving you there?
I don't think this is any different than most people going through their teenage years, but I think that I was very, I had no identity and I had no passions. And I think the reason I had no identity was because, you know, I have a famous dad and a famous grandpa, and that fame sort of informs who you are. So I wanted to etch out my own identity with a more rebellious, angry, drug addicted sort of persona.
Go the opposite of what your father and your grandfather are,
yeah,
in terms
because
of that. But did you also think you wanted to be, through the haze of all of that, that you wanted to be an artist of some kind, whether it's a writer or a director or producer, that you wanted to do something in this business?
No, I had no idea. And that's what aided to the drug use, was because I had nothing to fill my time. I had nothing to look forward to.
Well, wait, you're a teenager in high school. You're living, your parents, as famous as they are, seem like they're very normal people. Your dad coached T-ball.
Normal. We're crazy.
Well, we're
neurotic,
all crazy.
Like
my
everybody.
Mother, yeah, we're right. But my point is, there are things to do in high school, right? Like, whether if it's not sports, it's music, chess club, I don't know. Your interest didn't really lie anywhere at that point.
Well, I was really into basketball, but I'm a white Jew, so I couldn't really continue that for a long time. And it just seemed like I didn't want to go into that business.
Yeah.
But now, you know, I'm going into it as a drug addict of a famous...
It's kind of ironic that the thing that...
This came out of it.
This came out of it, and you ended up... Do you find that, I mean, obviously I know for anybody with an addiction problem, it's day to day, but, how do you deal with issues that we all have? And now that you don't have drugs to use, can you talk to your dad and your mom more openly about things, or do you seek help other ways?
When he was saying before, like, how I was scared to get in trouble if I were to tell them the truth, because they always say, be honest, be honest, be honest, and that's the best policy. But it's kind of not the best policy when you're honest and you get in more trouble than you were
that's
if you
exactly
were lying.
Exactly what my son said. I'm going to send you this link. That's I said to him, because, okay, it's the summer, okay? We got a place up in Connecticut. So I'm walking down the street with my wife, and he rounds the corner with like four or five of his friends, and I can see the shadows, and he's got a backpack, and one of the kids has a backpack, and I hear, ditch it, and they throw the backpack. So as they walk by, my son's like all cool and doesn't really want to talk to me in front of his friends. I go, I'll pick up that backpack for you and keep it at the house, right? So I pick up the backpack, and it's filled with a bunch of Bud Light beers. And they had gone down by the railroad tracks, had a little fire, and they, you know, whatever. And this is like the first time for us to confront that, right? So I then interrogated him like a lawyer, and I got it out of him that, you know, he had paid for it. And, you know, it was a lot of like sort of obfuscate, I didn't do this, I did that, okay. And I asked him on the podcast, why do you lie? And he said, because when you do the calculation of the chances of getting caught versus telling the truth and the ramifications of getting punished for telling the truth, you take the odds of lying and getting caught for lying. Which I think is exactly what you
or
just said.
Or living with the guilt of lying. You know, you're like, I'll take that rather than getting...
Did you feel guilt? I don't know if somebody at that age feels guilt. Did you feel guilt?
I did honestly feel guilt. I'm not just saying that for sympathy points, but you feel bad when you lie to your parents.
Yeah.
But it's designed for you to lie, I guess you could say.
Yeah. And I was fascinated by that. And when you did the drugs, I guess it sort of just alleviated all of that. It took you away from all of that, and just it was obviously self-medicating, and just you were able to relax or feel relaxed. And
there was a level of self-medication. There was also a level of doing something radical and doing something to get outside of myself and comfort zone.
Yeah, yeah. What is? I had a friend who was in AA. He ultimately died, literally killed himself from drinking. And I remember visiting him, and he was in denial. It was all these other people. He literally was that line, like they got it. Did you get anything out of being in those different facilities? Were you able to take anything away long term that's helping you?
You know what I really took away, and I usually bash the programs in AA, but I'll say something positive, which is the the feeling of, oh, okay, there's other people out here that suffer from the same thing that I suffer from, and they're willing to talk about it. And that's why I think we did this movie, is because we feel it's important to be upfront about this sort of stuff.
So how was it, I can imagine, just me directing my son's work and then putting my butt in my nose in, and you're obviously a great writer, so... They wrote the screenplay, I would imagine, as a director. You maybe tweaked it in places?
I worked with them. I mean, over the course of a year, you know, I helped.
Was it hard to not, to give him his space, you know, and maybe, you know, want something to be changed but leave it alone because he really felt strongly? Or how did that, how was it for you working with him?
We hashed everything out. I mean, some things became fights, other things, you know, we hashed it out.
Yeah. He told me something that was really fascinating to me, and everything clicked after that. He was like, there's one person on the set that has to make the final decision. Whether it's right or wrong, it has to be made, and that's the director. And so after I heard that, I was like, okay, I'll do what he wants me to do. I'll try my best on it, but ultimately it's up to him what gets into the movie.
Yeah. But the other thing was, there were times when, you know, Nick would fight for certain types of things, and, you know, my first instinct was I have a lot more experience, but then as we went along, I realized that, yeah, I may have a lot more experience making movies, but I don't have a lot more experience on this particular subject, and particularly what the young guy is going through. So, right. You know, I told him many times he's the heart and soul of the film, and he would have better insights as to what Charlie was experiencing than I would, and I would defer to him a lot of times.
And were you surprised to hear the things that he didn't understand about you, or did understand about you when you were going through that as a result of the process of writing and making the movie?
We both had no idea where we each other were coming from, but then we
come on in, Romy. She just it's a
blockage.
A tissue, yeah.
Is that's your
that's our daughter. That's Romy.
Come in. You want to be on?
Oh,
all right. How old is she?
She's 18.
Oh, all right. Nice to meet you. Are you going to college next year?
Yeah.
Where?
Bennington, in Vermont.
Oh, yeah. I ski up there.
Wow.
My buddy John Fitzpatrick has a house up there.
That's so cool.
Yeah. It's great. Good skiing. And you'll probably get discount passes to go ski. That'll be good.
She's
nice
best.
To meet you. You're welcome to come on and talk if you want about anything.
I don't know. I mean,
whatever you want. Nah, it's about anything. It's loose. It's a podcast. That's the beauty of it. So, you were saying, sorry, that what you sort of took away from his interaction with you over the script and the film.
Yeah, we both learned what each other went through during that time. But really the thing I took away from it was I got to see him in his element sort of directing and doing all these things. And when I said that in the past, people would be like, well, weren't you on movie sets before?
Yeah, I was
but
just
it's,
thinking that.
It's different because it's something I wrote. It's my dad, and it's something that we're collaborating on. And I saw he has sometimes a hard time expressing himself through just conversation, but through his efforts.
What do you mean by that? Because it seems like he's very expressive through conversation.
Well, we're on a show right now. But
oh, really?
Yeah. No, but he's
I'm pretty quiet.
He's quieter, but he still listens. He's a great dad, and like I just mean that like he's best explaining himself when he's in his element, making a movie, showing his how much he cares through that way.
Do you think that that's the reason you do what you do, because you need? You're Jewish. I'm Italian. I think we're very much alike in a lot of ways.
I grew up in a neighborhood that was all Jews and Italians.
Yeah, in the Bronx. Yeah. So it's very expressive in this. Yeah. You guys have all the money, but other than that, we're the same. But I do mean that.
But you guys got the muscle.
Yeah, exactly. We make a good team. Do you think that in some subconscious weird way or life sort of aligning up for you that, Rob, this business has helped you be able to converse with people when you couldn't do it off camera?
And I think so. I mean, listen, no matter what area you go in, whether you're a writer or a musician or an artist or you're a filmmaker, it's a way of expressing yourself, you know? And sometimes you can express yourself through your work a lot easier than you can you know, in real life. And I think that's one of the reasons people do what they do. It's a way of getting their feelings out, their thoughts out, and they put it out either on a canvas or a piece of paper or a piece of music.
Yeah, that happened to me. I was doing these big M&A deals, but then I started writing as a hobby, and I made some short films, and one of them got into the Aspen Comedy Festival, and then that led to stand-up, and I liked the idea of writing something. And initially I got into this because on a lark I went to see Jay Leno at a private function, and I had all these jokes written, and I gave him the jokes, and he called me the next day and said, I'll hire you to start sending jokes in for the Tonight Show.
That happens a lot of time. You know, it's
crazy.
These two guys who worked on The Odd Couple and then on Laverne and Shirley, you know, Lowell Ganz and Mark Rothman, they wrote a screenplay for a thing. I mean, television thing, and Mark's father was a limo driver for Jack Klugman, and says, "Here, my son and his father wrote this. What do you think?" And they hired them.
He did my joke the following week, and it was the most
that must have been a thrill.
Call
see
me
something
up.
You wrote come out on the
calls
air.
Me up that day. Goes, "Hey, it's Jay. I'm going to do." I go, "Why are
hey,
you calling?" Yeah, it's like, "Why are you calling me? Don't you have people that have people that have people?" He goes, "Nah, I like to keep in touch. I'm going to do your joke tonight." So I got a bottle of champagne. I don't want to make this about me. And
did he kill it?
Yeah, did it real well, and my head exploded. He paid me $50 for this joke.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I'm a middle class Italian kid from Rhode Island. I'm working on these $1 billion merger deals. Yeah. They paled by comparison. And then I started to go do the stand up, and I was living a secret double life where I was a lawyer on Wall Street by day, and at night I would sneak around to dive bars working open mic nights in my little suit and tie. And there's a whole, and then I was very lost in my life for a few years because I thought I had my whole life figured out. I'm going to be a partner at the firm, and I'll retire in Florida. And then this passionate thing hits me where there's that choice: do I stick with the money or do I go where I'm passionate? Yeah. There's no money. And I couldn't make a decision, and I was scared to death, and I was, like, looking to anybody for advice, and it was a very, very... I went through a midlife crisis in my late 20s. It was ridiculous, but... So you're working on another screenplay, you said, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and what was it about this that you thought could be a comedy?
Well, because... And the people that see this movie that have been to rehab, there's funny stuff that happens. Mm. And there's funny stuff that's said. And, you know, like he said, my first instinct is to make this a comedy. But he was wanting to bring the more serious element to it. But there's definitely funny stuff that happens.
And there's funny stuff in the movie.
Yeah,
hopefully.
If you see the movie, I mean, there's a lot of big laughs in it.
Yeah.
There's a couple of really funny scenes.
Is it hard to reveal that stuff for you? That would seem to be hard for me.
It's not hard to reveal that stuff. It's only hard to reveal that stuff to then get told, you're a spoiled, white, rich kid. And it's like, okay, maybe all these things.
Well, who would say that to you? Not your dad.
No,
but the world, you know. Listen, I had to talk to him about this. Listen, I know what it's like to be the son of.
Yeah.
And to have people assume certain things about you, and it's very, very difficult.
Well, how did you handle that?
Well, I mean,
obviously you didn't go to drugs, but you must have had those issues. Your father's an icon.
In the 60s, there was plenty of drugs around.
Yeah.
But you just have to know what you do, and that you have to block out all that extraneous noise. And it's hard for him because this is the first time. He's, you know, all of a sudden there's a lot of attention. People are talking.
Yeah.
And, you know, he has the double whammy. He's got me and he's got his grandfather, and they're going to say whatever the heck they want. But they don't know. They don't know what he's experienced. They don't know what he's gone through.
Yeah.
They don't know why he's done what he does. And, they, you know, and it's pretty dumb, pretty ignorant of people to say just because you're born and you have money, and that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
You know, people have their own issues.
Human beings
regardless.
Are complicated,
yes.
Messed
and,
up.
And also, it's like the Kardashians can go shopping and complain about how there's no air conditioning in the fucking store. And, you know, no one bashes them.
Yeah.
It's like I wrote a movie about doing drugs and having a hard time, and people still, you know,
people
have
really
field
said
day.
Stuff about that.
Oh yes, absolutely.
That's insane to me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you have to keep yourself focused and
whatever.
Know what you do. Yeah. Know what you do. This is what we set out to do.
Right.
And I told him, you know, while we were making the movie, I said, I don't care what happens. I don't care if, you know, they don't even see the movie. Nobody wants to see. I said, we're winning. We are winning.
Yeah.
Because we're throwing ourselves into our work.
Yeah.
And it good things are coming out of it.
Absolutely.
And hopefully it can help some people, because we've been on some shows. We were on a show the other day on NPR where people were calling in and were saying, thank you so much for, you know, sharing your story. And they were telling us about what they were going through. And so if you can be helpful in that way, then that's good.
And that must be good for you, Nick, to hear that, because it counteracts the negativity of people saying, oh, you're just a privileged white kid and all of that, right? I would imagine when you know you're touching people that way.
Exactly. And that's what we do it for, is to start that conversation.
Do you see yourself like in this business now in some capacity, or is this sort of just, look, you're young. How old are you?
22.
All right. So you're young. I was in my late 20s and just did a complete career shift. So is this just get this out and you want to go somewhere else with your career, or do you even know? And not that you have to know. It's young. 22 is young.
When I first started working on it with him, I was like, oh, my God, I want to do this forever. And then, like, when we started doing some of this stuff and I started to catch some heat for, you know, whatever. Like
on Twitter, like, and stuff like
yeah,
that.
I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, I don't want to do this at all. Like, this sucks. And but now I'm like, you know, he gets it even when he goes on the Tonight Show or whatever. You're the son of Carl Reiner. So it's just the nature of it, I guess.
Mm. They still call me Meathead. No matter what.
By the way, I had Norman Lear on the podcast, and he talked about how great you were. And he talked about the show. One of the episodes was so huge, it had like 60 million viewers, and there was people went to the bathroom and the water table changed in New York when they
Is
went
that
to
true?
The, yeah.
Oh my
yeah.
God, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That means the people went to the bathroom, they were all flushing at
the
same time.
Literally
millions
affected.
And millions of people.
Yeah. And he said, you had said real quickly as we wrap up, Rob, that Carol O'Connor was a support person for you in terms of like helping move you toward directing. And
well, not moving me towards directing, but he taught me a lot about acting, and that was that if the script is good, if there's a good story, the actor doesn't have to do that much. Mm-hmm. You have to just deliver it. I mean, you don't have to do any kind of, you know, handsprings and pyrotechnics with your emotions and acting. Let the story and the dialogue support you. And great advice.
I want to end on just a very funny story that I heard you tell, if you don't mind telling it. And it's the Mary Tyler Moore story where you touched.
I did. I talked about on that on Colbert.
Yeah. And
no, that's a true story.
It's a real. Do you mind telling it real quick?
I don't mind. I mean, it happened.
Hilarious.
I mean, it's not. I'm not telling tales out of school, because Mary talks about it in her book.
Yeah.
She actually told a story on the Letterman show. I was 14, and I was like, my hormones were raging. And Mary Tyler Moore was like this really sexy. She was 24, 25, you know. She had those hot capri pants and very skin tight.
Yeah,
I don't know what possessed me, but I just went and grabbed her tush. Just gave her grab, you know. And I was like, the devil was making me do it. And my father called me into the office and says to me, Did you grab Mary Tyler Moore by the tush? And I went, yeah. And he had a big smile on his face and said, don't ever do that again.
That's my boy. Well, it's a really great story. And I wish you much success, Nick. And it seems like things are going great. And maybe you write a movie for me and I'll get a little part in it or something like that. And
About a father who hounds his kid to play baseball.
No, you know what? We'll get your sister in it. He hounds his kid, who's his daughter, about skiing and being on a ski team in Bennington. So we'll all be in it.
There you go.
And then your dad shows up, and he's the old crusty ski guy that lives in a lodge with no heat.
And wait a minute, I think you're on to something.
and there's no plumbing, but he has the wisdom. He was burned by the spotlight of being an Olympic skier, but now he has the wisdom of life to impart on the three
of
us.
Everybody's scared of him because they think he's something, that he's a monster, but it's he turns out to be the...
It's like the Home Alone guy who lives across the street.
Yeah,
so anyway, such an honor to have you on, Robin. Great to meet you, and congratulations on the film. And it's called Being Charlie. Go see it, and we'll see you on the next show. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
All right, well, there you go. Rob Reiner, Nick, great story. They come together, they make this film, and just I couldn't believe I was sitting with Rob Reiner. It was really one of the highlights of my doing this podcast and why I do it. And you can also check it on video as well. We videotaped the interview, and it's available on my YouTube channel, Paul Mercurio YouTube channel, and November 25th and 26th. Come on out to Gotham Comedy Club in New York City, beautiful supper club. Go to GothamComedyClub.com for tickets. Punch in the word promo code Paul, PAULL caps, and You get yourself half off the ticket for being fans of the show. Thanks for listening. Check us out next week. And as always, please send the links around. I want to keep building the Paul Mercurio Nation. And review the podcast for me on iTunes. Always helps. Thanks, everybody.